This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
We talk a lot about how fast prices are going up, but maybe what really matters is how fast wages are going up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, April 6th. Good to have you with us. It's been almost a month since the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. And since then, much of the federal government's response has focused on banks' liquidity, ensuring that other banks have enough cash on hand if depositors want to withdraw their money. But the crisis also has the industry concerned about the other side of a bank's balance sheet. Loans. Marketplace's Justin Ho reports that we're starting to see some signs banks are pulling back on lending.
Late last month, the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas surveyed 71 banks in its district, and it found that loan volume fell for consumer loans, mortgages, and commercial real estate loans.
I do think that it is a sign of the beginning of tightening credit standards.
That's Myra Rodriguez-Valladares at MRV Associates. She says some banks are thinking twice about lending out money since bank deposits have been falling.
It's just making all banks nervous about their own liquidity, meaning their ability to meet all obligations when they come due, including depositors wanting to withdraw money.
If lending were to dry up and people can't get the loans they need, that'd be a disaster for the economy. But Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says that's not what's happening now. For one, falling loan volume is also a sign that people just don't want loans at today's interest rates.
You certainly see that in mortgages, for example, where fewer and fewer people can afford to get a mortgage.
And Petru says there are still plenty of willing lenders for anyone who does want to borrow, like a big corporation, for instance.
We're also seeing continuing credit available even in some of the higher risk sectors. The cost of borrowing is higher, but the money is there.
Lenders aren't only worried about the recent bank failures. Ishwar Prasad at Cornell University says banks are concerned about the prospect of a recession.
Banks are also anticipating that the months and quarters ahead are going to be a little rocky for the U.S. economy. So they're certainly going to be much more circumspect.
Economists surveyed by the American Bankers Association say they expect banks to tighten credit standards throughout the year as the economy and credit quality get worse. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, markets were a little jittery about unemployment numbers. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We found out today fewer Americans are filing claims for unemployment insurance, also known as jobless claims. 228,000 people for the week ending April 1st. Also on its way down is the pace of wage increases in this economy. Payroll processor ADP reported yesterday that pay growth for private sector workers decelerated in March, both for workers who stayed in their jobs and for those who quit to take new ones. Economists expect a similar story in tomorrow's jobs report. In general, this slowdown in wage increases is something the Fed will welcome in its efforts to tamp down on price increases. But rising wages are the very thing helping workers keep up with rising prices. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
What level of wage growth does the Fed want right now? Well, the goal for price inflation is around 2%. The standard formula for target wage growth, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute, is that you add
long-term productivity growth, that's about 1.5%, So anything in the 3.5% range is certainly not going to be driving inflation.
Some workers have been getting much bigger raises recently. Gould's been crunching the numbers for the lowest paid 10% of workers, many of whom are service workers who've been in high demand for the past couple years.
Those lower wage workers saw faster wage growth, about 9% between 2019 and 2022, much faster than at the middle of the wage distribution.
As wage growth slows, it's likely to hit workers up and down the income ladder. But even many workers who get raises are likely to lose ground as the economy slows. Dave Gilbertson tracks how many hourly workers punch in for how long at Payroll Processor UKG, which is a marketplace underwriter.
People are working less overtime, working fewer shifts per week.
Gilbertson says employers are facing slackening demand, higher interest rates, and economic uncertainty.
Companies are broadly trying to manage their labor spend, recognizing that there have been elevated wages over the last couple of years now. One way to manage is to allow fewer hours for workers. Over a couple of months, I think employees are going to be in a tighter spot financially.
Less money in people's paychecks will tend to help the Fed fight inflation, just hopefully without making consumers pull back so much it tips the economy into recession. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Julie Hsu, current Deputy Secretary of Labor, is President Biden's nominee for the full Secretary of Labor job. Biden announced the choice in February after the departure of former Labor Secretary Marty Walsh. But Hsu has struggled to get the necessary votes for confirmation in a divided Senate. More hearings on that are coming up later this month. Mel Leonore Barkley, a national politics reporter at the 19th, looked back at Hsu's days as a labor attorney in the 90s, particularly Hsu's role in the landmark El Monte Thai garment slavery case in 1995.
So these were 72 Thai immigrants, mostly women, who were working in sweatshop conditions in El Monte, California. The one worker that I spoke to told me that she was paid between 2 to 4 cents to sew pockets onto garments. She worked in the same place where she lived, you know, really long shifts. The money that she was paid to then use to buy food and toiletries and other essentials from a shop that was run by the same people that ran the sweatshop. The sweatshop really inflated prices. So it really was slave-like conditions. The windows and the doors were boarded up. There were security guards outside, so they were not able to leave. And eventually, federal agents were able to release and free these folks from these working conditions.
And what did Julie Hsu do for them?
So the first thing that Julie Hsu was able to do was to guarantee their release from an immigration detention center. After they were released, the one worker I spoke to, Nanta, talked about Julie helping her find a new job. And it was a job where she stayed out for 11 years, also sewing. And then that's where this landmark case really starts. But Julie worked with these workers to figure out how to guarantee back wages for them. And Julie built a case that not only held responsible the people that were running the sweatshop, but also all of the businesses up and down the line that were benefiting from their work.
What does Julie Hsu's role in all of this tell us about her views and how she might do her job if confirmed as labor secretary?
You know, she wrote an essay in 2021 about the El Monte case. And in that essay, she talks about watching her parents, who are both Chinese immigrants, arrive in this country and, you know, try to navigate work, having limited English and feeling that a lot of employers are predatory. She has talked about that being an inspiration for her to advocate for vulnerable workers, and people who support her to be in this position say that that passion could, at this really high level in the federal government, could just be an advocate for the most vulnerable workers in America. And they really believe that that voice is really necessary right now within the Labor Department.
Why do you think Biden is picking someone like Hsu right now?
You know, I think one really interesting thing about this story is that the same folks who are advocating for Julie Hsu to lead the Labor Department right now were doing the same when the president was first elected. And he ultimately went with a different labor secretary, and they feel that just her time is due. But at the same time, the country after the pandemic is in a really interesting place when it comes to workers in the service industry and the lowest paid workers. I spoke to one advocate who said that a lot of workers, especially in the restaurant industry, are walking off the job just demanding better wages. And she feels that the pandemic empowered these workers to do that. She believes that there is this really crucial moment of opportunity, and that somebody like Julie Hsu, who is interested in these kinds of workers, could help the administration seize this opportunity and help increase wages and benefits for workers.
So who is against her confirmation and why?
The opposition is really centered on business groups. They believe that she is somebody who would be hostile to small businesses. Right now, the Labor Department is working through two different rules that would impact businesses and that are being debated. And they just believe that the perspective that she brings to the job would harm their efforts.
How is Hsu and how is the Biden administration responding to those concerns?
Well, I spoke to one Hsu supporter who said that Julie Hsu is not hostile to business. She believes in uplifting businesses who take the high road and who treat their workers fairly and who pay fair wages. And so I think to them, if you are a business that is doing right by their workers, you know, Julie Hsu shouldn't worry you is I think the first priority.
Mel Leonore Barkley is a national politics reporter for the 19th. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
I've also written about 6 or 7 Christmas orders already.
It's never too early, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points, just a tad, to end at 33,485. The NASDAQ was up 91 points, 0.75%, to close at 12,087. The S&P 500 grew 14 points, 0.3%, to finish at 4,105. Justin Ho was telling us about the availability of credit almost a month after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. Wells Fargo picked up 2.7% after an upgrade from Raymond James, who said it believes the bank will benefit from recent turmoil in the banking sector. Bank of America moved up 0.7%. Bond prices fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note remains at 3.30%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. As recently as 2020, 18% of people living on tribal lands had no possible way to sign up for broadband internet service, according to the American Indian Policy Institute. And that compares with just 4% of folks in the rest of the country who have this issue. The federal government allocated $3 billion in the bipartisan infrastructure law for increasing connectivity in Native communities, on top of earlier pandemic relief funds some tribes are using to invest in broadband projects. But supply chain jams make it hard to get the materials needed to carry out these projects, skilled labor is in short supply, and there's lots of competition to secure both. So, as Marketplace's Savannah Mara reports, putting all that money to work has been tough.
It's been a little noisy with construction lately at the senior housing complex in Pawhuska, the Osage Nation capital. The payoff for all this racket? Soon the elders who live in these 30 stone-sided duplexes will have some of the fastest internet in Osage County, but there's a lot of work to do. Charla Lockman is here. She's waiting for an excavator to scoop away rocks and dirt so she and other technicians can lay down fiber optic cables.
What we're doing is digging the main line for the fiber to be ran to.
Once they connect these homes, they'll move on to other Osage neighborhoods.
And after we collect, the native households are going to go into the non-native so that we can communicate from Ponca City to Bartlesville all the way south to the north end of the county.
The plan is to build a 200-mile fiber network and a couple of wireless towers across this vast rural county, home to 45,000 people. Pretty ambitious for the Osage Nation's brand new broadband department called Wajaji Connect. Especially because getting your hands on fiber optic cable these days is like trying to track down a pack of toilet paper in March of 2020.
Gives you a little bit of anxiety not knowing when these materials are going to show up and if they'll show up on time.
Kelby Witham, a project manager with Wajaji Connect, says supply chain issues combined with a sudden surge in demand have complicated things. She points to the giant spools of orange tubing lying around this job site.
Oh, so conduit. This conduit is what protects the fiber in the ground. So the lead times on those were, you know, anywhere 90 to 120 days, even a year on some of the vendors that we were checking.
And this team is working on a deadline. They have 2 years to spend more than $50 million federal grant dollars on this project.
If we're not able to meet those timelines, I mean, that could be the difference in us, you know, losing our project or losing our funding.
It's a lot of pressure, says James Trembley, who heads up Wajaji Connect. Because all the outside attention and resources on tribes' connectivity woes won't last forever.
I don't think there'll ever be this type of investment, especially my lifetime. You know, I'm 68, so it's... But I don't even think in your lifetime.
Don't let a good emergency go to waste, right?
Matthew Rantanen is broadband advisor with the Southern California Tribal Chairmen's Association.
I don't know that we would have gotten the foundational dollars had COVID not happened.
He says it shouldn't have taken a crisis for the feds to take notice.
So tribes have always been without, right? Tribal people know they got to drive down to town and go to McDonald's or Starbucks or whatever your flavor of choice is to get free Wi-Fi.
Better late than never, he says, when it comes to federal funding. But he says it's frustrating to wait so long only to face novel supply chain constraints, plus competition with states who are also flush with federal broadband money and trying to buy all the same stuff.
We saw delays in product availability during the pandemic of over a year, to the point where products phased out of their lifetime before they were delivered. That's how weird it got.
And once tribes cleared that hurdle, they still have to find enough labor to carry out these projects on a deadline.
You know the game Hungry Hungry Hippo and all the marbles and all the hippos try to eat the marbles?
He says that's what it's like trying to hire a broadband project manager or technician right now. And rural tribes like Osage Nation are at a major disadvantage, says James Trumbly with Wajaji Connect.
It's going to be very difficult to entice somebody to move from a Dallas to Pawhuska, you know, I mean, it's virtually impossible.
So they started a training program with the local technical college, which they hope will create the workforce they need to build and maintain a fiber network.
People that are already here, we can get them trained, we can get them the skill sets.
People like Sharla Lockman, who's connecting elders' homes to fiber. She's an Osage citizen, background in IT. Osage Nation just paid her to take that fiber optic installation training, and she thinks she's found a new career.
I really enjoy this work. This is an opportunity for me to go further in my previous education, and there's a whole big world out there of opportunities.
This might be one silver lining to the chaos. Lockman and other successful trainees can count on years of steady, good-paying work right here on Osage Nation. In Pawhuska, Oklahoma, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Even if inflation is slowing, prices for many things are still significantly higher than they used to be, like cars. While the chip shortage that constrained inventory during the pandemic has eased up a bit, the price of new cars is still pretty high. A new report from auto research site Edmunds says the entry-level price for a new vehicle, once $20,000, is now $25,000, and the average buyer is spending much more. Marketplace's Christian Schwab looks at this one.
During the great car shortage over the last couple years, automakers used their very limited supply of semiconductor chips for their newest, shiniest, fanciest cars.
because if they can't sell as many, they want to sell the more expensive versions of them.
Mike Ramsey is an automotive analyst at Gartner, and he says somewhere along the way, companies stopped focusing on more affordable sedans altogether.
The Ford Fiesta, the Ford Focus, the Ford Fusion.
The Mustang is the only traditional car Ford has not discontinued. Most automakers are focusing on trucks and SUVs, and it feels kind of like a chicken and an egg thing. Are people buying bigger vehicles because that's what's available? Or are companies making them because that's what people want? Jane Ulitskaya is an editor at Cars.com.
All of the above. I think automakers definitely turn to the most popular models.
She says trucks and SUVs made up nearly 80% of new car sales in March. And auto research site Edmunds says of those large SUV sales, more than 90% cost more than $60,000. Michelle Krebs is an analyst at Cox Automotive.
The new car buyer is a fairly affluent buyer, and those buyers tend to want big sport utility vehicles with the fancy features, and the luxury part of the market has really grown.
Krebs expects the trend to stay, which means average vehicle sale prices aren't likely to return to pre-pandemic levels.
It's like gas prices. The prices go way up, but they don't come down to where they used to be, and we just get used to it.
One bit of relief, the sticker price is not always what you pay. As interest rates rise, incentives like rebates and lease deals are returning. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
In the retail world, when it comes to toys, after Christmas, the next big season is Easter. The National Retail Federation predicts that consumers will spend as much as $24 billion around Easter this year, and nearly $4 billion of that will be spent on gifts like toys. So we decided to check in with Irene Kesselman at Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina.
We have had Easter on the floor now for over a month, and it's been going well. We offer a bunny buffet that we set up in the middle of the store. Everything from Easter candy to Easter jewelry, Easter sticker books, and of course, plenty of stuffed bunnies. Our inventory right now is probably a little higher than I would like it to be. I attribute that to having bought a lot of items that, whether it was in shipping or the prices of the toys themselves, the items that I bought were given at a discount. I decided that I would bring them in, have them, and store them, and we would just fill in as we needed them. Our staffing right now is I think we're in a really good position. We have some part-timers along with the staff that I've had for many years, and the people that have come in for part-time work have really worked out well and are getting things done in the hours that they can give us while they're not in school. Biggest challenge right now, I would have to say, is finding some new items that we've never had in the store before, you know, to get the customer, especially the younger customer, to continue to come in and see what's new and exciting. In fact, my manager was putting out some stuffed animals today, and as she was putting them on a shelf, a young girl came in and said, "Did you finally get the stuffed lobster in?" "Yes, a stuffed lobster." And my manager was able just to hand it to her and say, "Yes, it just came in." And she said, "I've been waiting for this for so long." So that was nice to see. But, you know, keeping on top of trends and just things that I think are appropriate for our customer is probably going to be the challenge that I have over the next month or so. I would just like to see the traffic continue. Right after Easter, we are getting set up for outdoor in summer. And believe it or not, while I'm purchasing those, I've also written about 6 or 7 Christmas orders already. So I'm thankful for the traffic and looking forward to what the next 6 months bring.
That was Irene Kesselman, already putting in Christmas orders at Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. this final note on the way out today. At the top of the show, we were talking about wages, so let's wrap up there with a new survey out from the Pew Research Center about what happens when people negotiate for their starting salaries. According to Pew, men are slightly more likely to ask for a boost to starting pay compared to women, 32% versus 28%. But there's a bigger gap in what happens next. When people did ask for more money, women were more likely than men to only get what was originally offered, rather than that request turning into more cash. Here's your moment of economic context. One more thing when it comes to data on jobs in this economy. The pandemic really threw off the ability of federal number crunchers to do their normal seasonal adjustments to weekly jobless claims, which are pretty volatile anyway. Well, now the Bureau of Labor Statistics seem to have worked out a lot of the kinks, which, as pointed out by Axios, has resulted in some pretty big revisions to recent numbers, with more people filing for unemployment insurance than we previously thought. The job market is still pretty healthy in terms of unemployment, but the new, higher numbers give a bit more evidence that things are slowing down a bit. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawi is the managing editor, and I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.